Hey, we are shit. Another segment.
Hey,
it's another Baldy. It's another deliberation Baldy segment. We did Biggest Miss, right?
Yeah, this is where we left off.
Set me
yesterday.
Up for failure, you son of a bitch. No, all right, so here's a new category. I don't
set
think
you up for the surprise of the next category.
I think this is a new. This is a Baldy's 2017 OG original. No, OG would be the opposite.
Yeah,
of an original.
This would be something. This would be the best returning category.
Yeah,
we need to do some meta categories.
This would be the best debut or pilot category.
We're what, 4 years into this? I feel like it's time to start introducing meta categories. Best bald move category that didn't return this year.
Right, right. So biggest stakes, highest risks, and we intended to set Rick and Morty and Star Wars as counterexamples of things because we tried to, you know, anytime we got these categories, we should do the deliberations where we actually argue about why this stuff shouldn't be in here and what this category and why do we need this new category. But
yeah,
we're trying to think of things that, so. Why aren't Rick and Morty and Star Wars fitting in the highest stakes, biggest risk? Because...
For me, Star Wars doesn't fit in there because they're doing it every single... In the last 2 years, we've had 3 Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
So if they fuck one up,
they will continue,
they've just got another one coming out in 6 months.
Yeah, like, it's like the weather in the Midwest. If you don't like it, wait a day or two and it'll change.
Exactly.
Wait 6 months and you'll have the Solo movie.
Whereas like a lot of other things on this list, like there's a lot of hype, a lot of expectations, and they're only really going to do it like once. Like Blade Runner was a beloved franchise, not even a franchise, right? Like a beloved film from 30 years ago.
Right, there's no possible reason to remake it.
No real reason to remake it, and it has such like this bar of you need to make this great or everybody's going to hate you.
Yeah.
Star Wars doesn't feel like that anymore to me because they're going to make these things once a year for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Or until they stop making money.
Yeah, so. And the same with Rick and Morty. Rick and Morty in the pilot episode was conceived as a long-running 100 years Rick and Morty. Like, you know, like they're... Rick and Morty will always come back so long as it is popular and it gets good ratings, although more on that here in a minute, perhaps.
No.
But so let's talk about The Leftovers. What was the highest stakes risk of The Leftovers?
I feel like this is a very personal one for us in this category because The Leftovers is not a huge show, right? There's not like a billion people watching it like Game of Thrones. So if they completely fuck it up, you know, not that many people probably care, aside from... me, you, and probably Damon Lindelof.
Right. And I felt like...
But the biggest risk part of it is, holy shit, what if Damon Lindelof bungles the end of another series?
Right. Especially
like
since...
like Lost was bungled.
The sublime thing about it is both seasons previous would have been admirable series finales.
Right.
Like, they could have ended season one at the end with...
the fire, the big...
Well, no, like even Nora coming home and finding the baby, and like look at that, because that's how the novel ends, and it was a self-contained story. Done. Season two had a very nice arc and wrapped up in a satisfying manner. And I remember thinking, like, if this is the end of The Leftovers, then this is a great season. So coming back on such a controversial, polarizing, small show with the reputation of Lindelof, because that's every single time he came back, it's like. Even though I had a lot of faith in going into the third season, it's like, man, is he going to continue to be able to resist the temptation of sticking to his sci-fi, you know, sticking to his guns and you know, keeping it about the human element and the meditation on grief and depression and not try to explain things and not try to sci-fi things up. And in my estimation, succeeded. It seems like that's certainly the majority view.
Yeah, and it got harder every year because every year the show got better. So, like, my expectations
and
going
as the universe
into season
built,
three,
there was less, there was much more. He was they painted themselves into a corner with that show, right?
Because
every year you go by with Kevin doing weird shit, it's harder and harder to not explain that or to.
That's true. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like this crazy trapeze thing that they just kept on building higher and higher.
Right, right. So. You know, the possibility, the likelihood of really sticking that third season landing was not very high in my mind. Like, it just becomes this really big monumental task. So when they nailed it, that's what this category is all about, right? Like, how hard was the thing you're trying to do?
Yeah.
And how well did you do it?
Yeah.
And I feel like Leftovers for me was a huge bar, but it wasn't a huge bar for everyone, right?
Right.
So, you know, you have to take it, I guess, in context.
Stranger Things 2 was another one a lot like The Leftovers, where the Duffers had over a decade, however long they've been thinking about right. science fiction together, to come up with this fantastic universe and story, this love letter to 80s science fiction and Steven Spielberg, and then to turn it around in less than a year
mm-hmm.
and bring it back and try to please everyone and hopefully go bigger and better. And I was scared because I listened to them on the Harmontown podcast a month or two after Stranger Things had wrapped, and they were like, yeah, no, this is scary shit. This is following up your freshman album with the song, you know, that you've had mm-hmm. years to work and polish and write songs and come back with the sophomore. And they didn't have to, because Stranger Things, again, was a completely self-contained story. It did have breadcrumbs that could be yeah. easily interpreted as, you know, like at the end of Jaws, if they had another fin that goes, duh, dump, does that mean there's another Jaws, or just like, hey, stay out of the water because there's still sharks in it?
Right.
Like, when Will does the thing at the end, that could just be like, you know, like the stinger at the horror film that lets you know, hey, you got to still sleep with the closet doors closed and don't look under your bed. And
right.
And they did it.
Yeah. And where like Leftovers was a really personal thing for mm-hmm. me, like the personal bar, Stranger Things was a public bar. Like,
yeah.
holy shit, that show got so popular so fast
right.
overnight. And it was, in my mind, like almost a perfect season of television.
Yeah.
There were zero flaws with the first season of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
So to come back and try and do that again and do it bigger and better
yeah.
seemed like an impossible task, and I was so scared that they were going to fuck it up.
So the other spectrum is things like the Mystery Science Theater 3000 reboot that was on Netflix this year, where that's more of a combination of this is a sleeping dog
mm-hmm.
that it could have been left to lie, and Mike Nelson et al. From Mystery Science Theater 3000 have moved on to Riff Tracks. They are still doing Mystery Science Theater 3000 in a different brand.
True, yeah.
So the opportunity to rustle Jimmy's was super high amongst this fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't seen hardly any of them? Any of them?
I think I've seen part of one.
Like, I felt like it was a pretty rough start because I felt, and as a person who's done riffs, mm-hmm. like I've got a couple under my belt now, and also every time we do live watches of The Walking Dead, it's essentially a live riff tracks.
Yeah.
There is a temptation, like you'll remember when we did the Star Trek episode, to just pack it to the rafters with this riff, 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 riff. Oh, it's been 15 seconds, so we got to force a riff in there.
Yeah.
If you do that, it does a couple things. Number one, it destroys any kind of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Like you know, if you say something funny and you don't let it kind of land and you don't have a build up to it, then it's like, you know, it just becomes white noise. And I felt like
yeah.
a few of the early ones had that kind of nervous, not quite sure of ourselves that we've got the best material, like so shove it all in there. And then later ones got real good. In fact, the Italian Hercules is some of the best. Like, it's probably a top 10 of all time, Mystery Science Theater 3000, in my opinion. And I always, most of the time, I thought the host segments of Mystery Science Theater 3000 were pretty cringy.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a few notable ones. Like, I thought some of the work they did with, Lampooning Canada in, The Final Sacrifice was pretty good. But a lot of them, it's just like, Jesus Christ, can we just get back to the riffing? I thought the most of the host segments here were solid, and that helps that you had Patton Oswalt and, God damn it, the Guild Girl.
Felicia Day.
The other guys were just okay, you know, like the central star of Mr. Stein has always been the kind of a schlubby guy
mm-hmm.
who's not particularly charismatic. And there's a little bit bigger budget. Like they execute the low budget science fiction at a much higher budget. Does that make sense?
I know, because I've seen it. So yes, I get what you're saying. But
okay, yeah,
it's tough to explain.
Yeah. But no, I thought it was good, and that's kind of an amazing Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of talked about it, but it's, you know, this beloved movie that's only been done once, and everybody loves it who's seen it, and it's there's no real reason to bring it back other than we want to cash in on what we had with Blade Runner.
And you're going
to
bring it back with not even it's not even a Ridley Scott film.
I don't know if that's true. Is that
oh
true?
No, I was making. I mean, yeah, it's not a Ridley Scott film. It's Darren Aronofsky, wasn't it?
Okay. I don't know. I legitimately don't
know.
Oh,
so I was like, that was another risky element that you're going to come back yeah. with a... It'd be like if someone just came back and made a Star Wars without George Lucas before...
Oh, wait.
Oh, it was Denis Villeneuve who made it.
Right.
But, yeah, I felt like it was super risky because they're, you know, Blade Runner, everyone loves. I watched Blade Runner again, and the parts that hold up really hold up. You know, there's other parts that maybe don't hold up as much, but it's still... such an influential piece of science fiction filmmaking. Bringing it back is, you know, sometimes you get nervous about disturbing those kind of remains.
And I think of all of the questions, I guess, that people had leading up to the release of it, you know, about what part...
Harrison Ford.
What is his name? Deckard?
Deckard, yeah.
In the movie, what part he was going to play, whether he's going to be a replicant or not. And there were, like, a lot of opportunities to really fuck that up.
Yeah.
And I don't think they did. I think Blade Runner 2049 was a really good movie.
So.
And then, finally.
John Wick.
No, absolutely no reason to make a second John Wick.
Right. In fact.
No reason at all.
Like, just coming up with the motive. The first John Wick was such a pure action film in that it had such a simple concept. This is a man who had lost his wife, and she bought him a puppy to deal with that grief, and some asshole in the form of Theon Greyjoy murdered his puppy and fucked up his car, and he just spends the rest of his film making good on that red, getting that red out of his ledger, or putting more red into lots of people's ledgers.
And it was this very tight, like, self-contained thing that didn't need any more story.
Yeah. And I don't know that John Wick 2 was as successful, but it certainly did not disgrace itself. And it sets up what could be a potentially very cool trilogy. In fact, if the third one is not a disgrace, it's probably his most successful trilogy. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly wouldn't be like Speed.
Well, he was smart enough to come up, but I'm talking about compared to The Matrix.
Right.
Like, I think The Matrix is way better than John Wick, but Matrix 2... I think The Matrix 2 would have been okay if Matrix 3 was not just a completely...
But it's a much harder thing to do. Much harder than just...
Yes.
Keanu's going to go kick some ass.
Yes. I will say that making Matrix 2 and 3 would have been on the highest stakes, biggest risk. It just wouldn't have paid off, maybe.
Not quite as much, yeah.
Because the end of The Matrix is a self-contained movie. Like, you know, Neo is now a superhero. That's a cool concept to think about, but you didn't need to follow it up.
Right. The machines are done.
Yeah.
Neo's going to go kick their ass.
So we got five contenders for this here category. It's tempting just to maybe, is anything going to change? And also, how do we score this? Is this the best? Is this the best of this category? In which case, why are we not giving the leftovers? Kind of velocity between the stakes and the payoff?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, How crazy was it of a thing to do, and how well did they hit it? How well did they nail it? And for me,
I don't know that honestly, sheds much more light onto the situation because what do you think was the biggest risk?
So The Leftovers is not a huge risk to me because
they'd already
done it
once.
Personally, it is for me, but to the audience at large, I don't think it was even on the radar.
Right.
So many people could not care less about The Leftovers. I just don't think it was that big of a risk. Now, there is the argument to be made about Damon Lindelof himself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you come off of Lost and you do this as a follow-up thing, and then suddenly you bungle the end of this.
Right.
Now
especially since
you're talking about,
you had kind of shooken that monkey the previous two seasons. Every time you go to, but they would, that monkey was he didn't die, he was in the green room the whole time waiting to be called back out to jump right back on your back,
right? And you just invited it,
yeah.
You invited it and said, "Nah, monkey, I'm gonna stand here with my back turned to you, but you're not gonna jump on
right with a handful of bananas in my front pocket and just stay off my back."
So for him personally, I think it was a huge risk.
And for our fandom, I think, because the stakes, personal stakes for me, was I thought that there was a potential, if they really nailed the third season, that it might be dethrone The Wire as my personal favorite show of all time. Because...
Okay, well, we'll have to talk about
things,
that.
Unlike things like Breaking Bad that are merely excellent television shows, The Wire always had that, like, the importance, yeah. At least to me, because The Wire is one of the things that really kind of levered my politics into a different spot, and really had me rethink about how I saw the world and the people in it, and all of our places in it. But I feel like The Leftovers had that too, because no, it's not talking about the fundamental problems with, you know, 20th century and 21st century America, but it kind of is, our emotional maturity as a people and a nation, I don't know, has grown as fast as our interconnectedness. So, like, we are being asked to be more empathetic and understanding more than ever before, but we still have a lot of the Puritan and button-down 50s
that, like, survival instinct, kind of like,
just what are you whining about? Pick yourself up and keep going. Like, we are... becoming aware of trauma and post-traumatic stress and how it can really cripple people. And we're forced to deal with things like out-of-the-blue terrorist attacks. So instead of being just soldiers on a battlefield having to deal with it, like, it's our lives, our long stretches of boredom punctured by minutes of terror. And I think I had a lot of smart things to say about that, how you can survive and thrive and move forward in that kind of world.
Yeah,
so I think it checks the important box off, too.
Okay. Yeah, I could buy that argument. I mean, the personal connection that I felt to Leftovers was unlike any other show that I saw, certainly last year and probably previous to it.
Why?
Because
I know it.
Because, like, this is a story of people who have lost their families, right? And that's essentially what has happened to both you and I through our religion. I think, like, the connection that it made with me over that topic was far more powerful than anything else I saw on television, certainly this year.
Sure.
So that can't be denied either.
Yeah, I wondered if, because obviously in the first season, those things went hand in glove. It was literally about a family being torn apart by a cult.
Right. Yeah.
And not being able to speak.
The event itself, right? Like, these people just disappearing from your lives.
Yes. But this particular family that we focused on, none of that happened. It was this invisible wall that had torn their family apart, this, like, invisible iron curtain.
Right.
And, I mean, I fucking relate to that like it's my blood. And, you know, as the series goes by, that becomes less of an important element. But you're right, the grief of that loss portrayed through other people and other characters remains strong. So it's – because I was thinking about that as – you were talking, like, yeah, why did I still retain that personal connection? Because the cult stuff kind of gets dispensed with fairly early on, but and it's hardly present at all in the third season.
Yeah, I mean, it's still definitely influencing those characters' decisions,
right?
Going into the third season, so.
And I think it really, you know, like, they bring it back around by the end. But yeah, I mean, it's tough, and we'll probably talk about this more in the best of category. But The Leftovers is. It's the best thing I've ever seen that I'm nervous to recommend to everybody because it's just so it's like caviar, man. Like, if you like caviar, you will spend $300 to get a fucking gram of it.
Mm-hmm.
But or cocaine or
cocaine.
Or heroin,
the finest cocaine.
Yeah. But if it's not for you, it's going to just make you grit your teeth and chew on your fingernails and clean grout for 6 hours. And nobody wants that.
It has a charm of its own.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about The Leftovers. And that's why it kind of, you know, they could have really fucked that up. And it would have been personally devastating to me if that show ended on a really sour note. Kind of like Stranger Things too, because I know we have potentially three more seasons of that show, but Stranger Things 1 connected to me on that nostalgia level like nothing else ever has. And here's the most important part of it to me is I feel like this is the last opportunity for a while for a show to do this, because I think the next Stranger Things that comes out about the 80s is going to feel like a rehash.
Yeah.
Whereas Stranger Things it did. I mean, I've seen like a lot of 80s nostalgia come back in the last few years. It's not like it's been absent, but
and a lot
Stranger
more is coming.
Things,
Ready Player One,
absolutely. But Stranger Things nailed it in a way that like I don't think I was prepared for. I didn't think was possible. And so when Stranger Things 2 comes along and says, we're going to do this thing again, we're going to take this thing that you absolutely loved and didn't really need a sequel, and we're going to do it anyway, I was so nervous. So nervous that they were just going to fuck up this thing that so perfectly encapsulated my childhood.
You know, the next step for the nostalgia train wagon is the Mad Men look at the 80s.
Like from an adult perspective?
Well, just how fucked, everyone thinks of the 60s and, like, you know, I think there was a time where, like, it's the Flower Children and you know, Peace and Love and Woodstock mm-hmm. And then Mad Men was, like, peeling back and, like, for a lot of people, the 60s were a really terrible time that not be looked back fondly. And I bet the 80s, there's a lot of similar because the 80s, you know, there's nothing, no one, Ryan White's not dying of AIDS.
No.
In Hawkins middle school, even though he the real life Ryan White did in Indiana. Yeah. There's, you know, rampant Wall Street greed and cronyism isn't leading to a banking and loan scandal. Mm-hmm. There's an Iran-Contra deal that's raging in the background. Like, but that all was happening. Yeah. That all was happening. And the rampant sexism and homophobia and
I'm not nostalgic for any of
that. No, I'm saying, but that's like you said. What's the next dose of? I mean, I don't know that there will be another because I don't think you can get that high. You can't get that dopamine like every. And in fact, that's one of the things I'm worried about with Ready Player One because it looks like it's just 80s nostalgia with a thin veneer of plot to kind of justify it. Whereas,
but it lacks that personal connection to me of the setting because like Hawkins, Indiana is such a perfect encapsulation of that.
And my understanding of Ready Player One is it's literally people being nostalgic about the 80s together. Yeah. Whereas Hawkins, they're just in the 80s.
And I feel like this show doesn't speak to everybody in the same way because if you didn't grow up in the Midwest, you're probably not as nostalgic for that thing. You're probably more into like skateboarding and you know the shit that
was Stranger Things 2 is all about
California or New York.
Yeah, skater girls and Stranger Things 2.
That's true. Yeah.
In fact, I felt like that was a little bit of that. Like they imported some California vibe.
They didn't.
The shithole Indiana in season 2.
They totally did. Yeah. The skater girl for sure. But yeah, that was much more of a thing on the West Coast at the time. And like what was going down in New York, you know, like the hip hop scene and stuff.
Right.
Like what that wouldn't speak to me as personally.
We need an embarrassing teacher rap by Mr. Clark. Yeah. My name is Mr. Clark, and I'm here to say...
We'll get the student from New York
I like
next
doing
year.
Science every day.
Yeah. That'd be great. But yeah, that I mean, like I said, the Midwest flair of it all spoke to me.
Okay, Mystery Science Theater 3000, since it was a mixed bag in execution, I'm assuming they're going to do another season. I'm really looking forward to that because it seemed like they rounded into good shape. The other thing I enjoyed about Mystery Science Theater 3000 is... Oh, it's hard to get old copies of Mystery Science Theater 3000 that don't look like total shit.
Yeah.
These just
did they release them on DVD?
Even if they did, they were standard def at the time.
True.
So it's like you're only going to get so good. And these just all look just amazing. And they're not distracting that way. And they're able to do a lot of fun things with Tom Servo being able to interact with the environment because he could like float around the stage and do like visual gags that way that they, you know, I don't think they had the shadow box technology to do that back in their Minnesota cable access days. but I feel like it feels to me like Mystery Science Theater 3000, that's got to be at the bottom because the execution was uneven. It was a brave and risk, and I think it paid off, but I
would argue everything else on this list executed at a higher level.
Yes. So by that, and it also wasn't that big a risk. I mean, like Joel Hodgson was involved and, you know, Mike and the guys are already doing their fucking thing over on Riff Tracks. And I didn't think that there's animosity behind that. And it was also a public Kickstarter. So they raised like
Netflix. A Kickstarter for
The Kickstarter was to resurrect Mystery Science Theater 3000, and I do believe Netflix then won the rights to distribute that thing.
Oh, okay,
and probably kicked in cash too. So yeah, I think it goes to the bottom now. Leftovers, Stranger Things, 1A, 1B. Like, I feel like almost that's that one tweak did it for me.
Hmm. Because I'm thinking, like, Blade Runner is pretty high up there. Just because of, I guess, the built-in love. Like, a lot of people love Blade Runner. And it has been around for so long, and there's been so much discussion about it. And people have definite ideas on what they think is going on in Blade Runner. And to bring it back, especially with, like, Paul Gosling at the front of it. Ryan Gosling.
His brother Paul.
His brother Paul, yeah. His identical twin brother Paul, who sometimes stands in for him when he needs to do some heavy lifting and acting.
Yeah, the equivalent Gosling. He's not even the lesser Gosling.
Right.
He got an 87% on the thermometer.
Okay.
So I feel like, because I thought I remembered that this was a little bit more controversial. 81% on the audience score, so like it did seem almost to get universal praise. I know there's some people that had problems with it, but I enjoyed it. I mean, fuck, I love Signs. I actually thought it surpassed the original Blade Runner.
Right. I feel like a lot of the criticisms are nitpicks. Like,
yes,
we don't like that you explained this stuff with Deckard,
or it's slow.
Or it's slow, yeah.
Well, even you
problem with some of the pacing. And
whereas I thought the pacing was vital to the point they were trying to make.
Right, right. But, so, I mean, thematically, it's hard to really knock that movie.
But you're going to put it higher than Stranger Things?
I don't know. I mean, the bar feels a little bit higher to me just because Stranger Things is such a new, recent occurrence, whereas like Blade Runner has this built-in love over decades.
That's true. That's true.
So I might just be trying to justify
the
myself
stage
not
higher.
Putting leftovers.
Like, you can't get a higher stage than category. International blockbuster movie release, whereas Netflix is as a subset of a subset of a stage.
Right.
You know? That's the other thing. It's like Leftovers happened on the biggest stage on television, like HBO.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you put Blade Runner above. So you're wanting to put Blade Runner above Stranger Things? I could get behind that.
I mean, I feel like at this point I'm trying to convince myself not to just put Leftovers at the top of every category.
Well,
Which sucks, because if it deserves it, it deserves it. But
yeah, we can't. I mean, that's a horseshit reason to not give something awards. Like, we're not the fucking Emmys over here. So I think it can go above Stranger Things. I don't think it can get above The Leftovers, because this is the Baldies. This isn't some objective,
right?
You know,
that's the problem I'm running into.
A thousand industry insiders vote on shit that they haven't seen. This is ours. This is our awards. And unfortunately, this isn't going to be one that has audience participation. A lot of these meta categories don't.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, I don't know how all that's working.
Yeah, because what are you going to have a write-in category for this? Like,
yeah, if this wasn't the Baldies, if this wasn't our award show, that would probably be number one.
Really?
Yeah, because it's way bigger. I mean, nobody cares about The Leftovers.
Yeah,
except for critics and us. Like, what, 400,000 or 500,000 people watch that show?
So we got Leftovers. I mean, that's the thing, is we didn't invent this category to give another award to The Leftovers.
No.
In fact, the way this worked is we tried to talk ourselves out of including it, but we realized that if the category is valid at all, like, The Leftovers hit every one of the criteria we were trying to get at.
Yeah, except for maybe popular appeal.
Well, that's popular appeal's not part of it. It's just how high of a stake is it in your quality versus how much. Did you have a 3-season contract? Did you commit to
I mean, hype, I think, is part of it, though.
Yeah, it has to be a combination of how high you are stepping off of a platform and how much you have to step off that platform. Like Blade Runner satisfies both of that, because it's a widely acclaimed film that has been dormant for years. Nobody was clamoring. There's not an online petition.
Right.
There's not a studio trying to resurrect it for a franchise. This is you walking off a cliff because you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think season 3 Leftovers is the same way. You're right. It doesn't have as high of exposure, but the quality cliff, like season 2 of The Leftovers was, I said at the time, was the best fucking season of television I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
the only reason I wasn't giving it the best series is like, well, I mean, it's fucking two seasons versus The Wire's five. That's kind of shitty,
right,
to do to Simon. But yeah, now it's got three seasons. I think I'm I think that's the other thing about this Baldies is I do believe I'm ready to say that The Leftovers is now.
Whoa. Save it for the drama category.
I'm talking about, I mean, who knows if it'll win this year?
Oh, come on.
Who knows if it'll win this year? But, okay.
If it's the best thing you've ever seen on television, period.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Of all time.
Maybe Handmaid's Tale will be there.
Maybe 20, I don't know about 2017, but all time, sure. all right. Yeah, fair. Fair criticism.
Okay.
Are we good with that?
I think I'm happy with that, yeah.
The return to form category.
Oh, shit. Okay, so this is a...
We're going to have to break these videos up into smaller chunks. There's no way someone's going to listen to a three-hour video.
I mean, we can do that now if you want.
Do you want to? Because I feel like I think we already fucked up. We needed broken it up earlier. So I'm cool with keeping running the cameras. I just think we need
to... Sure.
Okay, so return to form.
So this category is shows or... I guess movie series
that we had written off.
Started off really good and got crappy, and we were just like, yeah, we're done with that.
And suddenly, out of nowhere, they were relevant again.
Yeah.
Fargo.
Didn't have a terrible season two.
Like, you know what?
It wasn't as good.
There's a thread right now ranking Fargo's because Noah Hawley said that he was going to take a time off from Fargo, but now I guess he's got a lightning in the bottle because he has recently announced that they're actually working on season four.
Oh, no. It's going to hit, like, October.
I don't know. I don't think, because if every other season of Fargo, they have to film during the winter because that's part of the charm, yeah. So I doubt it. But, yeah, so Fargo season two, and this is very controversial, but if you listen to our podcast, we didn't like season two. We didn't like especially the way it ended.
Not as much, certainly.
Season two is super good. Mm. That the climax completely left us
Yeah,
cold.
That alien shit was no, not my thing.
Season three, the first three episodes tried really damn hard to run me and Jim off.
Yeah.
And then by doing a lot of really interesting international geopolitical economic themes, turned out to be one of the more important things that I watched and had.
And having a truly menacing villain.
Yes, David Doulas.
Disturbing and disgusting.
I had to turn my eyes away from the screen at this man's mouth on several occasions. Yeah. It had Ewan McGregor playing a twin character and doing very good space work with that, and characterization aided and abetted by some heroic facial prosthetics and wigs. it had Carrie Coons playing a very reserved and generous performance where she, like, I thought that Carrie Coons was just going to eat everyone else alive. Mm-hmm. I think she could have, but that wasn't her character and what she was there to do.
Right.
It was another one where, like, I was like not super excited about Noah Hawley and starting to think, like, you know, with our body work that we've seen of him, you know, starting to think like, okay, not sure if this guy is going to be any more than what I'm seeing already. And then he came with, like, Legion and Fargo season three, and it was return to form.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he's on this list. And again, I know this is a minority opinion. I was just browsing on the forums on Bald Move, and people were ranking the seasons. And I think I'm the only one that went 3-1-2.
Huh.
I know I was the only one that I was the first one's like, well, I guess I'm a weirdo, but 3-2-1, baby, or 3-1-2. And a lot of people will be like, well, you're just a fucking idiot. And Fargo 2 was so much better than Fargo 3. But this is the Baldies, not the everybody's. So Fargo is on there. Mr. Robot, I think we already discussed.
Yeah.
In fact, some of these things, like what did we end up doing with the biggest surprise? Trying to think, like, if the Young Pope is going to win the biggest surprise, maybe we should get Mr. Robot and Star Trek Discovery off there, because what's the argument for Mr. Robot and Star Trek Discovery being on the return to form? Because return to form implies it's a surprise, right? Like, isn't that just double dipping for them?
Kind of, yeah. I think you're right. for the same reason we took off the one I can't think of.
I think I stopped taking them off. We might have to clean that up for the actual show.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm going to put asterisks on that. You should
reopen the biggest surprise date or debate.
No, I'm just going to put, I'm going to italicize things that are more of a return to form. And then we will see what happens. So Fargo, Mr. Robot, everything we said stands for this. If you didn't listen to that segment, essentially we thought Mr. Robot 2 was a disappointment building on the promise of Season 1, and Season 3 found the way to take the threads that were important from Season 2, make them even better, and pay off both the crazy speculation people had put on and also the hopes for a more mundane, rooted in reality show in a way I didn't think was possible. Like, I thought there some part of the fan base was going to be alienated.
Mm-hmm.
Like either is going to be the Doctor Who timeline or Time Lords, or is going to be the autistic hackers. One of those audiences was going to be fucking livid about how things happened.
They're stringing along everybody, and I can tell you this is going to be a lost scenario where we get to the end and one of two things happens, and half the audience goes fuck this show, half the audience goes yes, that's exactly what I wanted.
Counterpoint, Leftovers. Okay. Because there was a minority of the people, and it's a very small minority because it was a small audience to begin with, but a small minority of people said they're disappointed, but the majority of people, whether you thought one thing or the other happened, still loved the way that
but
everything
they left
came
it
together
ambiguous.
Thematically and emotionally.
They left it ambiguous in a way that I don't think Mr. Robot can do, because Mr. Robot is talking about very concrete things here, right?
True, and Sam Esmail said, is going somewhere. I've got big plans, right. Where Lindelof was like, fuck everyone. This is there's nothing supernatural here. There is nothing, you know, like I'm never going to talk about this. Yeah, so
they intentionally rode that line through the whole series. Yeah. Whereas I think Mr. Robot is riding that line up until the moment it can't, because it has to say something.
Okay.
So I'm worried about Mr. Robot, but this season, yeah, they did a remarkable job stringing everyone along.
And because it was so good, all of the other, what you would call, like, creative masturbation just worked.
Yeah.
Like, their weirdo episodes were fun, mm-hmm. and, like, as much as we liked the Alf and Full House Mr. Robot episode, it was fun, but it was like a clown, a birthday clown walking into, you know, Sam Esmail jerking off. Like,
sure.
What, you know, whereas all the fun, crazy stuff that happened in this episode, this just felt like of a piece. And, like, the crazy risk-taking, like, the single Warner episode that was uninterrupted by commercial, like, all that stuff just worked.
Mm-hmm.
Star Trek Discovery, again, Star Trek sucked for a long, long time. J.J. Abrams brought back it as a action franchise, which has kind of progressively lost gas. Star Trek, I think, has returned to form. And
so
Discovery was an apt subtitle for it.
Yeah, here's the asterisk on this one. I haven't seen most of Star Trek Discovery. I've seen like 3 or 4 episodes
of it. Nobody's seen the whole thing in 2017.
It's airing right now.
Because, yeah.
So I don't know what that show is exactly. If it's more of the action-y, because the stuff I've seen has been more of like the action-y kind of stuff. Like we're in a war, more akin to like DS9 than...
It does feel very DS9 because there's a lot of morally ambiguous gray things. In fact, this is the first captain that's just not heroic.
Yeah, sure.
So I
don't know, like, when I think of Star Trek, I think of that sense of exploration and discovery and trying to do all that in a peaceful manner. In this, I get a little more of that DS9 feel, which is not bad,
mm-hmm.
but it's not exactly what I think of when I think of Star Trek. But the return to form here is really just how good it is, right?
Can't we get back to a utopian Star Trek? Like,
right.
Is it about, like, is it,
about
is there
aspirations?
Nothing,
like,
is there nothing, if you look out in the world scene, that someone could say, here,
nah, we fixed it
here
all.
Is a, like, oh, like, here is a vision of the future where everyone's getting along and we can talk about social issues in, like, a future construct where, like, you know, a wiser futuristic person can tut-tut at what we're doing in the 21st century, and I don't know. Like, call me a crazy dreamer, but I would like for Star Trek, its next series, to be back to more Roddenberry roots. Maybe you can't go back. Maybe you can't.
I would like Star Trek, the next series, to be...
That's what it should be called, Star Trek, the next series.
Just completely automation-based. Like,
why
are we sending humans into space?
Yeah, it's an automated starship.
Let's just send... We've got these amazing computers. Let's use them.
That'd be a terrible show.
It would be. Always... Wait, you're telling me that a bridge crew manned strictly by Datas would be a bad show?
Well, why would you even make them Datas? They should just be automated systems of the Star Trek, the ship.
Because it'd be a bad show otherwise.
Right. Your idea is like this, like, is this, like, there would not even be a bridge set. It would just be like a circuit board.
No, it'd be the Borg cube without the Borg.
It'd be isolinear chips, and it would, like, run into some space phenomenon, and there'd be long silences, mm-hmm. and, yeah, I don't know.
There'd be no English.
It would be interesting to envisualize, like, okay, so set Star Trek 1,000 years in the future where the Enterprise is a bioorganic organism.
Okay.
Like imagine Captain Picard as the Starship Enterprise.
I've seen him as Locutus.
There's
I don't really like
but there's
him
no,
very
there's
much.
No there's no crew to bark at. Like it's almost like a first person account of this Char child exploring the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Next Generation did that. Like there is a living starship and they Caesarean mm-hmm. section the baby out of it, and like I want to see that thing story. Anyway, Always Sunny. Always Sunny in Philadelphia, in my opinion, was running out of steam coming into its latest season. And there was just as many misses as there were hit episodes. And this season was a return to fucking hilarious form.
Hmm.
And it culminated in the departure of Glenn Howerton from the show.
I don't think I've seen
you haven't, this and I kind of want you to see a couple, like the first couple episodes, just to have an opinion on this show for the comedy because it's real good. It's real good, and you're the one that got me into this show.
Yeah, so, I catch it on Netflix. So I'm
right,
a year
that's
behind.
Why you're a year behind. Yeah. But yeah, I thought you know, not that Always Sunny ever got bad, because even in the seasons where it was off, there was always like Charlie's. You know, Charlie's Work or Charlie's Day or something like that that was good. But this last season was almost, with maybe one episode misstep, was just real good.
Hmm.
Did we put Justice League on here as a joke? It clawed its way up to mediocrity and averageness.
Maybe.
And enjoyability. You never even saw it.
I didn't even see Justice League.
Thor Ragnarok was returned to form because I thought the first Thor movie worked because it took what I've always considered a somewhat silly character.
Mm-hmm.
That is nevertheless a powerful and important part of the Marvel lore, and leaned into it. You know, he came to Earth spouting Shakespeare and looking like fucking, you know, the greater Hemsworth with long hair, and Natalie Portman treated him accordingly. Mm-hmm. And then Thor, the Dark Elves bullshit, came out and went way emo and important and Lord of the Rings, and it was a snooze fest. And Thor Ragnarok took the Clippers to Thor, put him in a buddy film with the Hulk, and injected a whole bunch of Guardians of the Galaxy fun up its ass, and it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed myself. Thor returned, like, never taking back to any kind of serious roots ever again.
It's tough for me because I haven't seen the second one. So Thor has always been pretty good.
You don't need to.
Okay.
The Foreigner.
Jackie Chan
came back and made an action film that not only did he not embarrass himself, not only did he still have the moves, but was actually a pretty good film.
I'm going to say I don't know if this belongs in return to form because Jackie Chan has done some bad comedies, but he has never done bad action. Jackie Chan always does really good action, and that's what he is. Like, he's an action star. I know he does a lot of comedy stuff. But in my mind, he is a martial artist who is willing to do horrible things to his body.
If it's been a decade since he did his last action film, which wasn't even that much of an action film, The Karate Kid.
Yeah.
And if he's done other things in between there, I apologize. But, I mean, the fact that he's got the moves and he's got this, like, old man gravitas he brought to the role that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, it was a more dramatic role for him, certainly.
Yeah. And it made me feel good because I was expecting to have to pull some punches. you never have to pull punches. He just always going to dodge them. Punch me as hard as you can. I'll just dodge them. I suck. I have to pull some punches with Jackie because he's lost a step, and I did not.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Homecoming.
That maybe should be in the biggest surprise category, honestly.
That's not a bad way to look at it. Okay.
Because we were both expecting to be kind of sucking air through our teeth the whole time.
Well, the other thing is, like, The Foreigner, like, I don't think it's going to make noise in either category. I just wanted to say I love you to Jackie Chan one more time. Do you want me to do that?
One more time.
One more time. You never know.
Do I want you to move it?
Yeah.
I think that feels more right to me.
I'm going to do the same italicized treatment so we can maybe do an off-air deliberation. I mean, it won't change our arguments. It'll just be what shape to take. So Spider-Man Homecoming, Sony had destroyed Spider-Man, an interesting Spider-Man. The Garfield, like, I don't know. Is this a controversial take that the Garfield versions of Spider-Man were shit?
No.
The fact, and Marvel, so Marvel gets Spider-Man back. They call it Homecoming, which is already cheeky. And they've completely forego the origin story because everyone fucking knows it.
Yeah.
And they soft kind of brought him back in Captain America 3, Civil War.
Which had me super excited for Spider-Man Homecoming.
And they just went into it. And it's this story of it's essentially a Spider-Man 2 kind of film where he's got to deal with his – I mean that's what Spider-Man's always been his best is when he is an unsure of himself teenager – unsure of his powers, unsure of his place in the world, you know, wanting to be this, but also wanting to have like wanting to be the hero, but also wanting to have a normal life. And I feel like they nailed all that. And the way they used Robert Downey Jr. was particularly good as a foil for those ambitions. And I mean, it was fun. It's also, I think I've seen it twice now. And I like Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man a lot, but I don't even know what this kid's name is, but he's Peter Parker and he's Spider-Man. He's the first, I think, successful fusion of all those things. Like, you know, he's just too old.
Yeah, I mean, I like Tobey too, but I think this kid is perfect for the role.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the sublime pleasure of seeing Keaton playing this Birdman after playing Birdman after playing Batman and finding himself back in a superhero role as the villain. Also Michael Keaton's really good.
Yeah.
I think we've rediscovered him in the last few years.
Great actor, yeah.
So Spider-Man Homecoming, Return to Form, and Logan. We already talked about Logan.
We did, yeah.
So who had the best Return to Form?
We might have to start ranking.
All right. Well, is Logan better? Logan a bigger return than Fargo?
Man.
Well, let's do this. Let's do bottom up. That's how we did the other one.
Okay.
Is Logan better than Spider? Is Logan a better return to form than Spider-Man?
No, because I don't think X-Men had sunk quite as deep as Spider-Man.
I've seen every X-Men. I did not see Amazing Spider-Man 2. That looked like hot ass, and all the reviews. The
Spider-Man was in the dumps under Sony, and I don't know. Marvel's going to bring it back.
I mean, that's how far it was in the dumps. Sony sold it to Marvel.
Yeah, like, we can't do anything with this. So
All right. So is Spider-Man a bigger return to form than The Foreigner? Yeah. Well, I mean, I think obviously because under your new Foreigner logic.
Yeah, for sure.
Is it a bigger return to form than Thor Ragnarok? I mean, Thor was never the biggest, strongest staple of Marvel in any way. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm comfortable with saying it is.
Okay.
Justice League, yes, because Spider-Man 2, or the Amazing Spider-Man series, was about DC, the average quality of a DCU film, and Spider-Man was fucking awesome, and Justice League was just okay.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger return to form than Always Sunny?
I gotta look up previous season.
It's hard to tell with Always, especially since it's been a year since I've seen it, and you've not seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better than Star Trek in your mind? Is it bigger return to form? Spider-Man,
bigger return to form than Star Trek. Man, I haven't seen a lot of the new Spider-Man movies. I'm trying to think if I've seen any of the ones that Garfield's been in.
Probably not. You don't like comic book movies anyway. Did you ever see Spider-Man
3? I saw
3.
It was fucking terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
God, was a train wreck. Yeah, I mean, based solely on 3, I think it was more of a return to form than Star Trek. Because Star Trek was bad, but never in the way that Spider-Man was bad.
Really?
That, I mean, that third Spider-Man Voyager, was a piece of shit. I hated every second
of Voyager
watching.
As a whole is a piece of shit. And
it,
there's
I don't
a lot
like
of
Voyager,
it.
But there are some good episodes in Voyager. Maybe it's just the sheer amount of it. Like, you can pick out some kernels that are okay.
I was going to say, because, like, but, there's always Tobey Maguire's, like, weird Venom dance that he did in 3, I thought was pretty funny.
Really?
Yeah.
I hated every second of that movie.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Especially right. The dancing parts.
Okay. Bigger
I would put it up there,
Mr.
but
Robot.
I mean, this is both of our list, right? So if you want to make an argument for Star Trek being higher.
No, because the other thing is I haven't seen all of Star Trek. Mr. Robot or Fargo, the thing is, like,
I was more disappointed by Mr. Robot season 2 than I was by any Spider-Man letdown ever.
But you, well,
because
that's not, might not have been mechanically possible. Like, I don't think
exactly,
Spider-Man
yeah.
could have let you down because you
no.
just like, fuck this, I'm out.
Yeah, it couldn't have, which is my argument for Spider-Man staying right where it is.
Okay.
And then the debate becomes Mr. Robot or Fargo.
So you're, I mean, the, okay. I feel like I'm pretty happy with the top 5. Like, I would... First of all, I get rid of Justice League. That was a joke, I think, that I made.
Okay.
Return to form. Probably Logan over Thor. That feels right, period. So now let's argue about the top 4. So I, right
now... You don't
want
to leave your joke in for the actual, like, ceremony thing?
Do I? Not really.
Okay.
Because I don't... I mean...
It's fine.
I feel the DC fans. I know what it's like to be a fan of a franchise that has fallen kind of on its face and to be reflexively defensive about it and not like, even if you grudgingly admit the truth, you don't like to be told of it. So, like, I try not to poke that bear.
Okay.
So
I'm going to say...
It's not your fault, Will.
That we are, like, stratified into rough chunks here that are roughly good. I want to debate number 1 and 2 and number 3 and 4.
Okay.
Swapping either of those. Fargo versus Mr. Robot. In my opinion, Fargo season 2 was not nearly as bad as Fargo or Mr. Robot season 2.
Agreed.
I think Fargo season 2 had a pretty good run up until the end where
yes.
It took a turn that I hated.
And Fargo's pedigree, like, I trusted Holly and his casting and his creative choices more than S-Mail at that point, because I was a little shaky. I was a little shaky when Mr. Robot started to pivot into a larger series at the end of season 1.
Yeah.
And then season 2 kind of confirmed all that, where Fargo was like, I was loving everything Fargo season 2 was dishing out until the very end.
Yeah.
So
I think we should swap those two.
Okay.
Call Mr. Robot a bigger return to form.
All right.
And it probably wins this category. What about 3 and 4? How do you feel about those? Because you seem to have some minor problems.
Well... I mean, they're almost identical, because I watched, so I maybe not, because I watched the first pilot episode of Enterprise and maybe 2 or 3 episodes beyond that, and then I mm-hmm. stopped, which would be the equivalent of me walking out in the first 10 minutes of The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which I didn't even
okay.
make, I didn't even
yeah.
get that far.
Right.
But on the other hand, Spider-Man, as soon as it got bought by Disney and he showed up in Civil War 3, or Captain America 3 Civil War, I instantly was like, I am expecting really big things. So, like, to call Spider-Man Homecoming, like, the fact that Disney and Marvel bought him back off of Spider-Man was the return to form. And this was just it worked out exactly how I expected it to.
I feel like that might be why... some of these things made both categories biggest surprise and return to form.
Right.
Because, like, I guess the distinction there is it couldn't be that big of a surprise if, I guess, a studio that you really thoroughly trust and a company
right.
that has made great stuff takes it over, then it shouldn't be that surprising. Or at least it shouldn't be as surprising as, you know, Star Trek, who was essentially run by the same people
mm-hmm.
and turned out to be just a much better thing than they had previously made.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we made smart changes to the categories that, like, taking Spider-Man and Star Trek out of biggest surprise and putting maybe the Foreigner back in there feels right.
And I'm kind of thinking swapping, well, return to form. I don't know.
I didn't even see the last Spider-Man where I actually gave Star
right.
Trek a chance.
I think that might be the order.
So it's like it just wins by a hair or a spider thread.